This podcast is a copyrighted production of Radio America and is not intended for broadcast. Welcome to Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry. It's your family, it's your finances, and it's your future. Home and Family Finance is brought to you by the Defense Credit Union Council, serving those who serve our country, and the Credit Union National Association. Now, here's the host of Home and Family Finance, Paul Berry.
Oh, yeah. And as always, excited to have you here on the show with us. Thank you so much for joining us on this wonderful day. We have great topics, great guests, and we have you. And this makes it just a perfect union as we talk about things that have an impact on your home, your family, and your future, and your finances. It's everything that we do is kind of based around dollars, folks. And sometimes we just don't take care of business the way we should. We don't save the way we can. We don't invest the way we can. And then when it comes tax time, we do or we do not get a return. And even then, it may not be what it could be. And that's one of the things we'll be talking about today. In our second half, we'll also be talking with Christian Greenaway, who is the executive director of the Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum. What's going on with the nonprofits, with museums and areas where we take our kids? Are they thriving and surviving in this tough economic winter as we enter what we hope will be a more delightful spring and summer of good, solid financial support for these institutions. But right now we're going to begin with Sandra Block. Sandra is a senior editor, if you will, with Kiplinger. She joined Kiplinger back in June of 2012 from USA Today, where she was a reporter and personal finance columnist. Now, she's done an article, and the article says, Kiplinger, 7 money-saving tips to learn from your tax return. Now, I think this is a perfect time. You get a tax return. It could be better. And the reason it isn't better is because you haven't done your homework. Sandra is going to tell us how, and now's the time to do that, how in 2016, when you file your 2015 taxes, you may do better by managing your mutual funds the right way, by even establishing a new bank account, and she'll explain why, or making sure that those retirement contributions that Generation X and millennials are not so certain about these days. They just don't have any confidence in that. But anyway, let's talk to Sandra about all of those things. Ms. Block, it's a pleasure to have you on Home and Family Finance again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You must be frustrated from your angle when you look and see what people can be doing, but they're not doing. And let's first talk about that our tax returns can be a lot better, can be a lot bigger. Is that true?
Yeah, they really can. And I think that one of the advantages of doing your taxes yourself, or at the very least going over the return after you get it back from your preparer, is it can tell you a lot about your finances. It really sort of lays out your life in money over the past year. And there are so many things you can learn from looking at it.
Wow. Okay, so how do I know what to know, Sandra? In other words, I don't know what you know, but I'm getting the sense that you're saying this isn't complicated. It just means that you've got to be interested and know what to look for.
Yeah, and one of the first things that we point out, and this is sort of coming off a year when the stock market was very strong, is if you were really surprised by your tax bill or that your refund was a lot lower than you usually get, look and see if your mutual funds in your taxable account paid out capital gains distributions last year. A lot of them did. Those capital gains distributions don't really increase your wealth, but they do increase your taxes because they're taxable. So if you were surprised by your tax bill, that would be the first place I would look. And while I wouldn't necessarily recommend dumping the accounts that paid those distributions because that could trigger an even larger tax bill next year, it might be a sign that you should redirect your future investments to more tax-efficient funds so you're not surprised when you file your tax return for 2015.
And when we talk about mutual funds, we're talking about the stock market so that everybody understands, in case that's a word that they don't understand. If, in fact, they are paying big distributions, I should either change that or talk to my agent, my broker, and find out where I should go. Is that kind of part of the
Yeah, memory? And I mean, there are lots of funds that this isn't a problem for mutual funds in your retirement accounts because you don't have to pay taxes on those distributions. But in your taxable account, you should, if you have a financial planner or you do your own investing, look for funds that don't throw off a lot of distributions, and that's not hard to do. Index funds tend to be tax efficient. Exchange-traded funds are tax efficient, and there are some actively traded funds that specifically are designed to reduce this problem. So it's just something to look out for. It might be a one-time thing, but in a taxable account, this is not something you want to be worrying about.
Well, Sandra, what about? But I'm worried that if I don't get that distribution, I'm missing out on profits that my funds are returning to me. Is that realistic, or am I missing the boat?
No, because the distributions are basically just a quirk of the way that mutual funds have to operate. They're required to pay out their capital gains to their shareholders.
Okay.
But the amount that they pay out, the value of your shares are reduced by that much. So you're not really, you're paying taxes, but you're not really doing it. It's a sign your fund did well, but it's not really a sign that you made, you know, that those distributions made you richer. And ideally, in a taxable account, you don't want to have to deal with that because the taxes are obviously going to increase the amount of your profits.
All right. So just be aware that that it has a bottom. It has an impact. It could have a bottom line on what you end up getting next year in your tax return. If in fact you've picked up some income that you really didn't need and weren't expecting, but it can downsize your refund size.
That's right.
Okay, well, that makes perfect sense. So we take a look at that, and as you said, if you know how to, I guess, invest, you know what to do. And if you don't, you get to somebody that can help you and tell you where you can go. Because you can you convert from that fund from those investments into something else without having a penalty?
Now, if it's in a taxable account and you sell the funds,
yeah,
you're going to end up paying taxes on the gains unless you've got some losses to offset them, which is why I wouldn't necessarily say just sell all those funds. But certainly think about where your future investments are going to go.
Okay. We're talking with Sandra Block. We're talking about how to increase your tax return in 2016 for the 2015 season, folks. When we come back, we're going to also talk about your bank account. You making any money? Are they paying you any interest? And if they're not, what can you do about it? This is Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry. Glad to be with you. We'll be right back.
We want you to be a part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Or maybe just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
I have the pleasure of Sandra Block, who was with Kiplinger. She joined that company in 2012. She's worked for a number of stock market-related entities. So she's learned, and she's willing to share in her recent article. That's exactly what she did. She has her Bachelor of Arts in Communications from Bethany College, Bethany, West Virginia. She joins us from Washington, D.C., and we're talking about how to increase the bottom line of your 2015 tax returns in 2016. I love this because you're right. I remember when you used to look for money from bank accounts. Nobody does it anymore, do they?
No, and when you do your taxes or review your tax return, that's when this really hits home. And actually, this isn't necessarily a move that's going to lower your tax bill, but if the interest that you got on your bank account is so low that you didn't even get a statement from the bank because they're not required to send you one if it's less than $10. That's a sign that you should at least be thinking about looking for a little more interest.
Yeah.
You know, you're almost paying the bank to keep your money in some cases. So if the amount that you reported in the dividends and interest part of your tax return was, you know, less than a gallon of milk. Look at some online accounts. Look at some credit unions. Look and see what other options you have where you can at least earn 1% or maybe 1.5% on your emergency money or whatever it is that you're keeping in a bank account for liquidity. As I said, that's not going to lower your tax bill, but it's just a sign that maybe you're not doing the best with your money.
And let's talk about that for a minute, because I think in my generation and my parents' generation, you expected a return on the money that you put in the bank. It didn't have to, but I remember when you were getting 3% and 4% and 5%, and maybe even more if you put it in long term. And all of a sudden, well, maybe it wasn't so sudden, Sandra, but the bottom fell out. You know, most there's nothing offered or very little offered. Is this a comeback? Are we seeing a comeback in banks saying, okay, we're willing to pay because of online accounts? Or is it just good business practice for banks to say, hey, if I want your money, I got to pay an interest on it?
Yeah, banks just aren't. They don't care. The interest. First of all, to their defense, interest rates overall are so low that they're not making a lot of money on your money. But I think they really count on inertia. They know that a lot of people just put money in the bank. You know, they have an emergency account or money they're saving for a down payment, and they're not just paying that much. They just don't pay that much attention to the fact that they're earning 0.5% or less interest on that money. And what I'm suggesting is, when you look at your tax return, maybe that's a time to shake you out of that inertia. There is some competition, as I said, in online banks. But the really big banks, and in credit unions as well, the really big banks don't really feel the need to raise interest rates because so many people keep money in these accounts that's not earning anything.
And how do you offset that then, Sandra? I mean, can you say to a bank, or I guess you can shop for a bank that says we're going to pay you a little bit more than zero or 0.5. We're going to pay you 1%. And are online banks kind of precipitating that? Are they causing that to happen, or is it just people? If you want it to happen, you've just got to shop.
You got to shop. Yeah, I don't think you can call your big bank and say, "Hey, I'm going to take my money out. What can you do for me?" That's just not happening. Okay. I think if you want to earn more interest, you have to be proactive and you have to find a bank or a credit union that's paying higher.
And are credit unions generally better at doing this than banks or no?
A lot of them are. Again, okay. You got to shop around, you know, and compare it. But a lot of credit unions, sometimes they will have requirements. You have to have a certain number of debit charges in a month, or, you know, have direct deposit. But you can find good deals in credit unions.
Okay, folks, so when you get your return, take a look at it. If the bank if you see that your bank has paid you nothing, then Sandra says, hey, it may be time for you to shop around. Make a little bit of more money off your money than just letting it sit there and let them make the money and not share with you. When we come back, we're going to talk about retirement. And I'm going to talk about Generation X and the millennials and where they are and the sense that they had that, you know, this just not happening. You can't just think it's going to work out. It won't. We'll be right back. You're listening to Home and Family Finance on Radio America. I'm your host, Paul Berry, and I thank you for joining us. Home and Family Finance is sponsored by the Defense Credit Union Council. We thank them for their continued support of this program, and CUNA, the Credit Union National Association, dedicated to making all of us more financially fit. And if there's a topic that you would like us to discuss, please write to me here, Paul Berry at Radio America. It's 1100 North Glebe Road, Suite 900, Arlington, Virginia, 22201. Or you may contact me on my website at hffradio.com. We are always interested in hearing what you think we should be covering and your criticisms or your if you like what you hear, the way you say thanks and keep doing it. By the way, the Defense Credit Union Council and its member credit unions believe that financial readiness equals mission readiness and supports the efforts of military saves in their dedication to improving the financial well-being of our troops. It's so important that we support them all the time and believe in them. And Military Saves does just that. It's a year-round campaign that seeks to motivate, to support, and encourage military families to save money, to reduce debt, and to build wealth. You don't generally get rich serving in the service, but you can get yourselves in much better shape. As part of the Department of Defense's financial readiness campaign, Military Saves acts as a resource center for information on financial education and counseling. Check out its links to useful websites for military families where they can learn better money management, and they can find partners who can help military members achieve their financial goals. So, Military Saves, set a goal, make a plan, save automatically. Go to militarysaves.org for more information and take the Savers Pledge today. Whether you are in the military or you're not, saving is just good for all of us. So make sure that you put a certain amount of your weekly income aside. Could be $5, can be $10, whatever you can afford, but afford something, because you will appreciate that you have done this in future weeks, months, and years. My guest is the always lovely and informative Sandra Block. She is with Kiplinger. Joined them back in June of 2012, and her recent article is Kiplinger's 7 Money-Saving Tips to Learn from Your Tax Return. And what she's really suggesting is look at your tax return, see what it says, and see where you're lacking in ways to increase your bottom line when you get your return in 2016 for the 2015 year. You know what I'm surprised about? Let me read this to you, if I may, Sandra, okay?
Okay.
There was a recent study done by the Alliance Life Study of 2,000 Americans, including 1,000 baby boomers, they were age 49 to 67, and 1,000 Generation Xers, as we call them, ages 35 to 48. And they found that Gen X respondents were much more hopeless about their ability to achieve retirement goals and about their overall financial situation than were their boomer counterparts. More than two-thirds, 67%, of Gen Xers agreed with the idea that supposed targets for how much you need to retire are way out of reach versus less than half of the boomers. Simply put, neither did very well. Are you surprised at that?
No, I think that people feel, you know, they have so many competing financial pressures, and they see some of these, you know, reports saying you need $1 million to retire, and they just get discouraged and give up.
So what's the remedy here? Retirement contributions are so important, whether you realize it or not. How do you get people to understand that it's not just going to work itself out? You've got to make it happen.
Well, I think one of the ways that we suggest in this article is look at how much you benefit by contributing to a retirement plan when you file your taxes. I mean, when I first started doing my taxes, I really took note of how much the money I contributed to my 401k just comes right off the top, and it really hits home to you that maybe saving isn't as expensive as you realize, because it does cut your taxes by that much. That money is just not taxed, and it can really take a big chunk out of the amount that the IRS goes after. So again, that's one of the things I think people need to look at when they look at their tax returns, is how much the money they contributed did reduce the amount of taxes they owed. And that maybe that will give you the incentive or the motivation to increase the amount that you contribute this year so you can cut your taxes even more when you file your 2015 return.
Okay, so let this return be a lesson and an encouragement to you to do the right thing. If people want more information, where do they find it regarding this?
Well, our story is on Kiplinger.com, and it's called 7 Valuable Things You Can Learn from Your Tax Return. In the story, we mentioned, you know, how much you can increase, how much you can contribute to your 401k or your TSP or 403b this year. So I think that's all there. And certainly talk to your employer.
Okay. Sandra Block, as usual, you educate us, inform us, and leave us feeling better about our financial futures. Thanks for joining me. Come back and see me again soon, would you please?
Okay, thanks for having me.
You betcha. Coming up next, Christian Greenaway from the Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum. What are we doing to support our museums, and are they thriving and surviving? That's next on Home and Family Finance.
You're listening to a podcast from the Radio America Network. Find more podcasts of your favorite shows at radioamerica.org. Helping you be safe, smart, and secure with your finances. Welcome back to Home and Family Finance with your host, Paul Berry.
And, you know, Sandra Block from Kiplinger's was very good about looking at that tax return and to see where you can increase your bottom line, meaning the amount of return that you get. One of the things that we did not talk about is that you can also make contributions to nonprofit organizations, and there are thousands in all forms, shapes, and sizes. One of the things that I think that's most important for us is our history and how to sustain it. And one of the ways we sustain our history is by through museums that keep relics, keep representations, keep idioms, things that represent where we have been, and very often will tell us where we're going. One of those places that I have had the pleasure of visiting and working closely with some of the folks there is the Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum. And I think the Chesapeake Bay is indicative of what we have in this great country. It belongs to all of us, and it's just such a wonderful resource and a wonderful history. The person that is now in charge of the museum, if you will, is Christian Greenaway, who's been in place for, I think, about a year. She is the executive director or the president of the museum, and her job is to make sure that the museum thrives and survives and grows, and that it is properly pronounced and advertised and promoted, so that you know it's a place for you to go and to take your family. She joins us now to talk about how she sees what's going to happen. Christian, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thrilled to be with you, Paul. Thank you very, very much. From a beautiful sunny day in St. Michael's, Maryland.
You're already starting, aren't you? Come on down.
Yes.
It's beautiful here.
Yep.
Oh, that's great. That's great. You left academia to take on this job in the field of nonprofit museum. Why? What drew you to say, okay, I will step aside and do this? Why?
Yeah, it's a good question, Paul. The majority of my background has been nonprofits, working with universities in London, Rotterdam in the Netherlands, in the U.S. as well, and also a lot of my background growing up in New Zealand has been living on the water. My father built a 32-foot sloop sailing boat, and we lived on that for a couple of years as preschoolers. Went away with my parents. Closed everything up at home and went away with two kids and came back with three. We have a family joke. We just rowed my mum ashore in time to have my brother. And then only came back for me to start school. So every single weekend and pretty much every 6 weeks over the Christmas holidays, which of course is summer in New Zealand,
yes,
we would be out at sea. And
wow.
So all my life has been messing about in boats, as Ratty so aptly put it. So to come to have the honor and the opportunity to take this position has really been a great natural progression for me. Before I started here 10 months ago, my last 6 years were working at Duke University at Duke's the National Museum of Art at Duke University. So an introduction, a fabulous introduction to the museum world from there. But coming from a strong university background where the focus is education, and bringing that embedded concept to the museum industry, mm-hmm. particularly the maritime industry, is a really key central concept. And I feel that museums, probably all around the world, their central focus really is education.
Mm-hmm.
And the opportunities that museums give the world, give children and adults the ability to use their resources as a resource for education, is so, so important, and has really got to be mined and utilized, and that message put across to everybody that this is a place to come where you not just only have fun, because that's another key element, of course,
sure.
but you can learn so much, not just as a K-12 student, and we have a myriad of programs for formal education, but the informal education that you can get is just so, so paramount and so important to society. To give people that opportunity. I feel probably, Paul, that's probably one of the base concepts there.
It's just interesting, but I want to ask you about mindset. In my day, my generation, museums were held in esteem and an honor, and you
yep.
went there and, you're even quiet going through. But what about Generation X and millennials? What about is it cool to go to the museum? What is your finding there?
Yeah, this is a really good question, because a lot of it now is based on, as you quite rightly said, the concept that to go into a museum, into a museum setting, is that element of quiet, which in the concept of art museums, I still think in some respects is a very important part, because the beauty of being able to stand in front of a painting and have that, or an object,
mm-hmm.
and have that reflective moment where you can imbue yourself with not just the beauty of the work, but what resonates with you, what may be a meaning that resonates with you as well. And the ability to be able to do that in a quiet atmosphere has a lot of benefits. But the beauty, and I think one of the key aspects of, say, children's museums nowadays, is that ability to be as noisy and rowdy as you like and getting the most fun out of it. I think this is a key benefit for maritime museums as well, that invariably we're on a, down here in Maryland, we're on an 18-acre campus with 12 buildings spread across the campus that are exhibition-based.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the ability to get on an old skipjack, the E.C. Collier, that's in a building. You can haul on the ratlins and the main sheet, and you can move the boom across, and you can go down below and lie in the bunks and listen to the sound of the sea passing you by. And then in the boatyard, which is our living exhibition, and there's a major concept for museums as well, is how do you incorporate the living side of your mission? And for us, it's the boatyard. We have shipwright apprentices in there. We've got full-time apprentices. One of our chaps who's working here for 30 years.
Wow.
We're building boats from scratch. We're renovating and repairing boats. Just a couple of years ago, we relaunched the Rosie Parks.
Yes, I remember that. That was fascinating. And I learned more about the history of the Eastern Shore when I saw that. I'm talking with the president of Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum, Christian Greenaway. We're talking about why museums should be important to you, what you can learn there. And in a moment, she'll talk to us more about the Chesapeake Bay, but also what she sees as the future for museums. Are they going to thrive? Are they going to survive? This is Home and Family Finance.
We want you to be a part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Or maybe just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
You know, you have, God has blessed you with children, and maybe they even are now adults and maybe grandchildren. And you have the option, thanks to the history that we have in this country of preservation of things that are important to us, to take them to any number of museums in this country, including the Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum, so that you can go to this 18-acre campus site in Eastern Shore of Maryland, and your children and you can learn about how people did what they did years ago, and why it's important to sustain the bay, and that's important to Christian Greenaway, our guest here, who's talking about whether museums are going to survive in this environment today. Things have been tough, and oftentimes we don't remember to either support or to visit. So, Christian, when you look into your maritime museum crystal ball, what do you see for your museum and for other museums? Are people being supportive or not?
No, the museum was founded in 1965, so this year we're celebrating our 50th anniversary. In fact, we've got our big birthday party, public birthday party, just not this but next, on May 23rd on the Saturday. So we're thrilled to people to come and see what we're doing to make sure that this, to ensure that this museum survives for a minimum of another 50 years and beyond. And it is imperative because we are a repository for the memories, for the sense of place that is a huge part of what the Chesapeake Bay is all about. Mm-hmm. And that may be demonstrated through the people that we attract to the campus who tell their stories about being crab pickers, oystermen, watermen, what it was like working on their craft. And then, of course, we have 60,000 objects that help represent the history and that sense of place. And we've got the world's largest collection of Chesapeake Bay watercraft, and it's our responsibility, we take this very, very seriously, to ensure that those boats retain, if they're kind of past they're on the water time. Mm-hmm. We have them on dry dock here where they're out for view. And then we have a very impressive fleet of floating fleet. And we have, for example, 1889, the Edna Lockwood. It's the last sailing surviving bug eye in the world.
Wow.
And that's we're in a year's time, we'll be starting on a major restoration project for that. It's a nine-log bug eye, so it was built out of nine logs. And we're now looking for the logs to rebuild that.
Crowley.
Which is no mean task.
And not only is it no mean task, it's not an inexpensive task. It costs money. You just mentioned the boat that you all just finished. How much did it cost to repair the, I think, what was the name of the boat?
Yeah, the Rosie Park. That was a $500,000 project.
Wow.
And the rebuild for the Edna Lockwood starting in a year's time will be nearer to $600,000-$700,000.
Well, what about contributions? Are people willing to, I point out that if somebody's listening, you want to make a contribution, you can tell them where and how, but and also what it costs to visit the museum. Go ahead, just kind of bring us up to date on that.
Our website explains it all, CBMM, Charlie Bravo, MikeMike.org, O-R-G, is our website, great new website, and you can find a donor page there, but you'll find out all the events that we've got going on and our collection, how to be a part of what we're working here. I'm just amazed that there is support that not just the local community gives us here, but also wider. And you think our annual budget is just around about $4 million a year, and that includes the staff, the volunteers, incredible volunteer, 250 volunteers,
wow,
which we could not function without that. And this is another crucial part of museums around the world, mm-hmm, is the opportunity for volunteers to be a part of this, but also the growing realization I feel with many museums that you cannot do business without that amazing volunteer corps. So,
but is it cool? Are young people looking at this as it's a cool thing to do? It's the right place to be, and are you getting that sense, or are they?
Yeah. I mean, Paul, if you know when you're here for board meetings or coming to visit, when you see these busloads of K-12 school students running to the entranceway and running onto the campus grounds and just looking around and looking at the Hooper Strait Lighthouse, you know, a late 1800s lighthouse that we have on campus, at the bell tower, at the boats, at the fleet that we have, and see that glow in their eyes and that chatter that they have, it makes your heart sing. It really does. And you realize why you're doing that. And I just got an email from one of my volunteers this morning who was with a group of school children yesterday giving them a tour. One child wanted to hold one hand, another child the other hand. He ended up the whole program having four children, two on each hand, wanting to be his special helper as they went around campus. It's phenomenal. It's just phenomenal.
Now, I know we're talking about the Chesapeake Bay, but from your standpoint, because you're in the industry, how are museums doing, both those that are maritime and otherwise around the country? Is this a tough time?
I mean, I think it's a tough time for everyone around the world. But if you think that museums in this country alone are a $21 billion industry, which is just over 3% of the United States GDP, that to me speaks volumes about the value of this industry. And often when you're looking at something that could be seen as more emotive, but if you see that the bottom line is of the value of museums, it really does strike you that this is an industry that is being supported by a great number of people who are as passionate as you are, Paul, mm-hmm, in supporting the museums that may be locally to you or not, but folks who do see the incredible importance of the museum as a whole. And maritime museums, I feel, are a growing concept in a sense, because the number of maritime museums in this country is, I think, it's about 300 and something scattered around.
300, folks. This is just one of 300 museums. The idea of folks here, and you write to me and say, you know, what should we do? Where can we do? Here's one of the things that you can. When we come back, we'll talk about St. Michael's, where this museum is located. And Christian Greenaway will tell you how to make contributions and how to call and what it costs you to walk through the doors there. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm Paul Berry. We will be right back. You're listening to Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry. My guest, Christian Greenaway, who is the president and executive director of the Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum, located in St. Michael's, Maryland. And she's talking about the future of museums and the importance that museums bring to us as Americans, as people, because it's a reflection very often of our history. And, you know, someone once said, if you don't know where you've been, very difficult to know where you're headed. And museums show us where we've been. It also is a place to tell us not to repeat the mistakes we've made, but to embrace the progress and the right moves and the right decisions that have been a part of our history. Christian, it's a pleasure to have you with us. I'm hoping that people hear this because from my point of view, I think it's such a wonderful opportunity to go, to get away, especially with the summer months coming upon us. And this is a high season for the museum. What are you looking for and what are your attendance numbers like? Have they been like at the museum?
We're very excited. We get 70,000 visitors a year, and that's something we're working on growing. So, I mean, that's a really great number for a maritime museum. We're one of the more popular ones in that respect. And the folks have a great opportunity to walk into the grounds and really immerse themselves in that sense of place of the Chesapeake Bay. When you think that the bay is about 3,000 miles of coastline with its tributaries, then for us to try and reflect that whole sense of that area is a big job, big task, and that's a key part of our mission is to make sure that we're representing that in a very authentic mm-hmm. way and making sure that we are preserving the elements that make up that sense of place and the objects that we use, such as the boat, the anchors, the bells, the sextants, everything that was used, the tonging, the oyster tongs, etc. that were used for everybody who works, lives, and plays on the bay.
Yeah, and let's talk about how people, if they are invited to join, are there memberships, and if there are, what does that cost, and what does it cost to come and visit? What would it cost a family of say 3 or 4 to come for a day to visit the museum, and how does that all work?
Yeah, well, we have great memberships starting from the individual at $60, but the household at $75 and family and friends at $100 per year get you free entry to the museum at any time, and it's $15 for an adult and free for children 6 and under. So it's great value to become a member here, and becoming a member supports all the activities that we provide throughout that year. So all the events, we have about 6 or 7 major events throughout the year that locals really know well. National Waterman's Appreciation Day, Oyster Fest, Party on the Point, Mid-Atlantic Small Craft Festival. Those 2-3-day festivals, our members get free entry to all of those, and again, every day of the year. And something really exciting, Paul, that we're starting this summer is a boat rental program. So you can come back every day and take out a rowing dinghy or a sailing dinghy, or we're building new kayaks, and you can get out on the water every day. I've learned since I arrived here that there are children who live just across the road behind the museum who have not been out on the water.
Isn't that amazing?
And I feel a great responsibility that we have to get those children out on the water.
I couldn't agree more with you on that. And by the way, St. Michael's ain't a bad town to visit. It's a very clean view.
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. The view from my office, I'm looking out the window now. It's the Bay of St. Michael's on the Miles River. The flags are flying. It's just gorgeous.
Al, let's go. Al Peterson, my engineer, and I are looking like, why are we stuck in this office? You're looking out over the bay. It's wonderful. In a more ecumenical sense, because I'll get clubbed by other museums that say, why weren't we on? The museum industry in general is doing okay, right?
I believe it is. We're a hugely important industry for the entire country, as I've mentioned. But there's nowhere else that folks can come to just have that time to be able to reflect or to experience. So here, for example, we're very experiential. But just to be able to sit and take a breather, look out over the bay, or look at a beautiful work of art and just feel your sense of place.
Christian, you make us feel like we're already there. Thank you so much for taking time to join us. It's been a pleasure to have
you
on the show. Absolutely.
Thank you.
And we will visit you soon, okay?
Thank you so much, Paul.
Absolutely.
I'm honored.
All right, folks. That's it for this week. Hope you enjoyed everything. Go to a museum wherever you are. That's an important part of this. Please. This is Paul Berry, along with Al Peterson, Home and Family Finance. We'll be back next week, same time, same place. Hope to see you here.